cliffcentral.com.
Alrighty, righty. Without any further ado, welcome to it. It's Thursday morning. It's 5 minutes past 11. My name is Tamisha Masha, and I don't travel alone. She's got a new hair color. It's the amazing. I can't think of another adjective.
I know.
Quickly. The amazing, the awesome.
We'll take that, whatever. Okay. It's Candace Mama.
Yeah.
You're really becoming lazy with these introductions.
I know.
You need to do your homework.
I didn't really work on it at home. It was like it kind of crept up on me as I walked
the
into
new
the
hair
studio.
Color?
I realized.
This is my old hair color. Like, it's not
your
really
old hair
new.
Color?
No. Oh. You haven't seen me in 2 weeks.
Is it that old that I forgot that? Oh, you know, it's fine.
Whatever.
Anyway,
whatever.
How was your trip away?
It was so much
you
fun.
You went to the Eastern Cape.
Yes. Remember the first time I went to the Eastern Cape?
The land
Cape.
Of my daughter's ancestors.
Yes. And the land of my ancestors.
Oh, yeah. Of course. You are actually part Xhosa.
I
must be careful what I say about you people today.
My people.
Yeah, your people.
Well, we're very intelligent. I mean, you can really
go into
it.
You know, the funny thing about Xhosa people is generally they start everything with like a sentence with like you ask them a question. Did you eat today? And the kill. Why is there always like a no at the beginning of every sentence when Xhosa people speak?
You're asking the wrong Xhosa.
Oh, you don't really know. And you can't. Can you say Xhosa for me?
you trapped me. You trapped me because I tried to like whisper it.
Sorry, people. That's your Xhosa.
I'm not a good spokesperson.
Okay.
I'm not.
So how was
your
trip though?
It was incredible. Incredible. There was so much hiking. There was like a lot of waterfalls. It was just unbelievable. Best trip I've had been on so far.
Waterfalls and hiking. I'm still trying to find the incredible part because like you said, the first thing you said was incredible. There was a lot of hiking. And you know.
But you're black.
Black people, we don't do hiking because it's like it doesn't make any sense. You spend your whole life walking to get public transport. Why would you go on holiday and just do that for fun?
I've been pampered. I've been a pampered pooch. So.
Oh, okay.
So I don't do that much walking.
Yeah.
I don't do that much walking.
I can see with your shoes that you're wearing today. Like those are impossible to walk in.
They're actually very comfortable, so shush. Okay. I will post the Instagram picture of them. But
please do. Just check out Candy's shoes later because these are shoes for people who don't use public transport.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Hey, I feel like I could get a taxi with these shoes.
Yeah. You know
like
those people who are never prepared, like, if things go sour
like
and they
if
have
the
to
car
walk.
Broke down.
Yeah. That's what your shoes are saying right now.
That is exactly
like, if
it.
The car broke down, they will send another car. Don't they?
They're optimism shoes.
Yeah,
optimism
exactly.
shoes. But back to my trip. No, it was unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. Like, I can't actually even think of better words.
Is it? You went down with some, like, really incredibly intelligent people. Did your IQ go up?
It did. It did.
Is it?
It did. Like, I actually came back feeling so smart.
Oh, okay.
And, like, actually so accomplished. Like, I feel like I'd accomplished something.
Don't take this the
wrong
way. I
did nothing, but I accomplished something.
Yeah, I don't want you to take this the wrong way, but I thought you'd be overwhelmed, like, out of your depth.
You thought. You really think very low of me.
That's why I said don't take it the wrong way. I was just looking out for you and I was worried for you. I was like, Shame.
Is that why you send me daily tips?
Yeah.
Like,
because I was like, Shame, I don't know what she's going to talk about. These people read books and stuff. You know?
I read books. What are you saying? No, honestly, though, I was so privileged. I was surrounded by such incredible people.
Yeah.
And like, I learned so much from the trip. I mean, you can't be in the company of such people and not actually be overwhelmed
speak
by
for a living international directors.
Wow, you really like going in there.
Yeah, I was
like, it's like you really want to just list them.
I was following you on Insta and I was like,
I didn't even post pictures.
Do they have space for one more black person? Because I'd like to come too.
The black quota was full.
It was full. You
like,
filled
it
that.
Was full.
I was like, no more. Sorry. You were like, I noticed you didn't send any locations because you were like, just in case my friends and relatives want to pitch up and ruin this for me.
Yeah, okay. No. Like, I was like, you know what? I'm very comfortable being a minority right now.
All right, cool. So,
yeah.
What's happening this week? What's the first thing that you want to talk about?
The first thing I actually wanted to talk about is that quote that we were actually discussing the other day, the people come into your life for a season, a reason, or a lifetime, right?
Yeah.
And basically, what we went into was just relationships, our friendships, our relationships that we get into, and how sometimes like you keep people in your life even though they don't want to see you grow or they don't support your growth. If anything, they actually sabotage your growth.
Yeah.
You know, so that's actually what I wanted to discuss too.
How do you know if, I mean, like a season, a reason
or a lifetime,
right? Because sometimes when you meet someone for the first time and you get all excited,
you're like, lifetime, baby.
Yeah, you're like, lifetime. You get put in the lifetime bracket.
Why do you think we want marriage?
And then a season later, you're like, I should never have married her because she's like taking my half my stuff again. And we spoke about this when we were getting married the first time, and she said she wouldn't, and now she's doing it like that last one did. Sorry, did I just go into a segue about my own life?
You really went deep there. I'm so sorry.
It's not supposed to be about me. It's a general thing.
You know what? When it happens to you twice, like, I don't blame you.
You start thinking you're the problem. But right now, I'm starting to think I'm the common denominator here. I'm the one who should not be. Okay.
Maybe anyway. Just don't get married next time.
I'm trying it again.
Third time's a charm, they say.
Third time lucky.
Oh, I hope so. For
everything
your
good
sake.
Happens in threes.
Let's hope. I mean, I'm excited because you know how to throw a party.
Yeah,
so I'm excited to be there.
You know it's gonna be dope.
I don't even need to be a part of the bridal party. I just want to be an invited
just
guest.
Just be an invited guest.
I will be so happy.
Yeah.
So okay. I'm actually looking forward to your third marriage.
Yeah.
I just hope you'd actually let me help you choose the next one, because all the others were like, you know.
Yeah. Don't worry. I think I'm in a good place. I think I've, you know. Yeah.
I'm sure you thought you were in a good place two times ago as well, and the last time. But okay, going on.
Yeah. You were saying.
You are
She's crazy,
me.
Baby. Don't listen to her.
And I've met your new girlfriend, and I feel terrible.
Yeah, you better feel terrible. And you said that on air. This is going to affect
I did. And it's a podcast.
This is
going to
affect
download
like
forever.
The whole custody battle right now. Thank you for that.
You know it's going to affect. You know what I'm sad about? I don't even care about your battles. I just think I'm going to get a table like in the kitchen now. Like, I'm not even going to get an
You're
invite.
You're not getting invited
Fuck.
Anymore. You're going to have to crash.
I'll have to show people where they park.
It's okay. I'll send you a location pin. Be like, oops, how did she get here?
No. Right. So you asked me, how do you know? How do you know if people are there for a season or a lifetime? I think it goes. Like, as life goes and flows and you are growing, if you're not growing together, you know, and you don't attempt to come together at any point.
The problem is, though, some people are with you for a season and it's a long season. I mean, 10 years is still a season. You know what I mean?
Long
it's still not a lifetime.
Season. Yeah.
And you get to the ninth year and you realize you got problems and this person needs to go, but you don't know how to say goodbye.
Mm.
And I always find that the longer the season that you've been together and it's time for it to end, the more traumatic the breakup is going to be. Because actually, you've probably been hanging in for the past 5 years too long.
And every year you're like, it's going to get better.
It's going to get better.
It's 365 days, man. It's going to get better. But I think the thing is, like, for me, how I evaluated it, like, after I got out of matric, right, out of high school, that year, I literally cut everyone out. I changed my cell phone number. I did everything because I realized that the people I was still hanging out with hated that I was growing and I was becoming different and I was questioning life differently. So I had to, like, I had to just get a new break. And I think 6 months into, like, having cut out everyone, I met my best friend, who was actually great for me because he actually supported my growth. And I realized what a healthy friendship should be like. And then after that, I really started meeting incredible people. So it actually put me in a space where I could choose the right people to come into my life, and not just because, you know,
but
we
people
share
say
time
that
together.
It's not you have not changed, it's the people around you that have changed compared to what you now have become, right?
They're not as responsive to what you are becoming.
I suppose it's like,
you know, in the relation to the MIS.
Yeah. Sometimes success or fame or getting a fortune or whatever changes how the people around you perceive you.
Do you think those are the only factors, though?
Because those are not the only factors, but I mean those sort of things. Because you said that your friends before were not responsive or receptive.
No, but it wasn't because I was becoming successful. It was just because, like, I had just decided to, you know, go on a spiritual journey, and they weren't supportive of that.
Basically,
and
you were building on to your success. You were at the beginning.
I was at
phases.
The bottom.
Yeah, you were at the foundation
the
stage.
Yeah,
but that's what I'm talking about, right? Because when you're at the foundation stage, you have to realize that a lot of things have to change.
Oh yeah.
This year I realized when I started doing what I was doing that some of my friends I had to, and it's sad for me because I love those people, you know, but I had to leave them behind because you arrive and you're like, guys, you know, I'm on this new journey now. I'm doing this thing and it's I'm different. There's certain things I just won't be doing anymore. I'd like to hang out with you like we did before, but we just won't be
in a club
drinking all night or that sort of thing like we used to. But, you know, we can hang out. You guys feel free. I'm just going to be over here drinking juice or drinking water because juice has got too much sugar.
Side note.
Side note. And maybe with a little bit of lemon in it, just so that, you know, you can detox while you're at it. Maybe I'm sounding like a nerd. That was their problem. Yeah. They're like, but why you got to sound like a nerd? But they're like, no, man, have a drink. Come on. And you know when your friends say that they're not for you, because what they should say is, oh, that sounds amazing. I'm really happy for you. Okay, tonight I'll make sure that you don't have a drink, you know, and I'm going to have some, But when I pour for you, it's going to be water with some lemon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I realized that I had to let go of some of those friendships because it was like they just weren't getting it.
That's the problem. And I'm not the kind of person who just cuts people out. I mean, I did just say I changed my number and I like move countries and stuff, but
that's what you had to do.
I didn't move countries. I just changed numbers.
Wow.
And deactivated Facebook, Instagram,
to your WhatsApp,
everything.
And I stopped taking your calls.
No, I'm a responder by nature.
In fact, I don't even respond. I just tell you like, dude, it's not working out. Let's not do this anymore. Yeah. Like a breakup.
Wow. Yeah. So you've gone through a lot of breakups.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
No, I don't tend to, especially with friendships. I think sometimes you don't want to sever a friendship. Sometimes you just need space and distance, you know, so you don't need to tell someone, I don't want you in my space. You just stop hanging out with them as frequently or speaking to them.
You just change your number and hopefully they'll get
that you don't want them in this. I found them again.
All right, cool.
You know, but
and
that's
the people
all.
Who are there for a lifetime, I mean, let's talk positive. What is it that they bring to you that you can feel?
Support. I think that is the biggest thing for me. Like, I mean, because, you know, life isn't full of just happy moments and highs, and it's not just full of lows.
I wish it was.
But, right. Mm. But then we wouldn't appreciate the highs. But, you know, the thing is, you have to have people in your life who are constantly supporting where you are. You know, so sometimes you're in a really bad space, mm-hmm. but you need a friend who's going to be like, you know, I'll just listen. And I'll help you through this just by listening, just by being there. And when you're going through highs, you want people who celebrate you and genuinely happy for you. Not people who are like, Okay. Oh, another one. Mm. Oh,
Well done. Well done on that new degree.
Right.
Don't you think you're studying too much now?
Shouldn't you focus on getting a husband?
Yeah. That's not support. That's not what support looks like.
You know, so I think those are the lifetime people. But I think with every relationship, you have to really value it and treasure it as it happens.
Okay.
You know, so that even if, you know, God forbid it does come to an end, you really take away the good from it when it does end.
Those are insightful. I mean, you should like really be someone who talks to the president about that, because like the situation that happened with him and Kosatu, I think that for me is like a clear sign that these people don't support you anymore. So it's cool to sever the ties. They were there for a season and maybe a reason, but definitely not a lifetime.
Our president has a lot of lessons to learn.
Okay, and on that segue, let's introduce our guest for today. I'm very excited that he's here. And I hope that you are too, because if you are interested in any way about television and film, now is a time that you should just like wake up and like start
turn up
listening.
Turn up your volume, people.
So who have we got in the studio? Introducing... Okay, he is a famous director of such television shows as Crossroads, such films as Spud 1 and 2, as well as E! Number Number, and now working out of Hollywood on a brand new film starring Gerard Butler coming to you at the end of this year. It's the man of the moment, Mr. Donovan Marsh.
That's a good intro. Can you travel with me?
I'll be your hype man. Like, as you walk on set, I'll be like, introducing, you know.
The one, the only.
There you go. How you doing, Don? It's
been a while
since I saw you. You look amazing, man. Like,
thank you.
You look L.A.
Well,
did you get some work done? Did you
that's what you do in LA.
I know plastic surgery there is
you pimp yourself.
Yeah, did you pimp yourself?
sure. Well, I pimped my career, let's just say that.
Okay. And how's things going there? I mean, first of all, from just a weather point of view, how different is LA to Joburg?
LA is so similar to Joburg.
Yeah.
Also, Joburg is the best weather in the world. In LA, they say they've got the best weather.
Oh, okay. Mm. So you're actually quite happy from that point. Because that's when you know you can probably stay. Because it's like, it's warm most days.
I think you're talking for yourself there, to be sure.
I'm definitely talking for myself. I couldn't live in England because of that. I mean, it was a great place, but I just couldn't take it.
You were too pale.
Yeah, of course. I'm a tropical person, can't you tell? But outside of that, how's work? I mean, I just read that you're doing this brand new movie and it's coming out soon. How was that? We're going to talk about what you've done before, but this one is the big one. How was, like, you had all the toys?
It's been pretty crazy. About 3 years ago, after I did E! Number Number, and that got recognition around the world, I said, okay, fine, I'm going to see if I can make a Hollywood movie, have a Hollywood career.
Yeah.
And I literally took 3 years out and I just stopped doing anything else, stopped doing television, stopped doing local work, and I just started hustling. And I had an agent there in Hollywood. And look, it took about 2.5 years of solid solid hustling to finally get in the door. You pitch on these projects with a whole lot of Hollywood directors, and finally I got one. You know, finally they said, yeah, okay, you're the guy, come on, come on board, let's do this.
Yeah.
And I'm currently directing a huge war thriller starring Gary Oldman and Gerard Butler.
Wow.
And
Gary Oldman as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't even mention him. Yeah, you know, yeah, and he's an amazing actor. What do they like to work with on a day-to-day basis? I know Gerard seems like he's a cool guy from what I've seen on talk shows and stuff.
To Michel, you know, I've worked with you. You remember that?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I forget, man.
I can say working with you is no different to working with Gerard Butler. He's just earning a bit more money.
Yeah, a little bit. Not much.
But he's no more. These guys are no more talented than the amazing South African actors I've worked with. You could be that big action star if you had those opportunities, to Michel. And we did a little action movie together.
We did Crossroads. That was a lot of fun. You know, I did my own stunts, by the way. I drove that.
You did. Look at you. We threw him off a few buildings.
Yeah. That's right. But I mean, like, just generally though, there's some people who you can tell are just like down to earth. They're just there for the work. And for me, Gerard is one of those real cool Scottish oaks, you know. He's like a bloke.
Well, you forget that these guys, I mean, have done 40 plus movies, you know, Gary Oldman. So they bring this incredible body of experience, which what we don't get in this country.
Yeah.
We don't have the experience of working at movies of that caliber.
Yeah.
So when you step onto a set with Gary Oldman, you better have your wits about you. You know, he's bringing 40 movies plus experience.
Yeah.
He knows exactly what he's doing. He knows, you know, what his sweet spot is, how to make the scenes work. And he's going to challenge you. He's not going to just sit there and take his direction. He's going to throw it right back in your face. You know?
Okay.
And so it was very, very real, you know, directing those guys.
How did you get around that, actually? Like, how did you, because I know you're a performance director, as much as you're very technical and as much as you know where the camera is at all times, you like your performance. You know, you like to talk to your actors.
No, absolutely. I mean, I love acting, I love performing.
You
have to be incredibly prepared. You gotta have your shit together, man.
Okay.
Otherwise they're gonna catch you out.
Let's talk about that for a second. What is the difference between preparing for a Hollywood movie and preparing for a movie here at home, like you did Spud, you know, and Number so what was it, how did you ramp it up?
It's the same but just bigger, you know.
Okay.
You know, make a movie for R1 million and then you make a movie for $50 million. You know, it's just times 50. That's all it is.
Okay.
But essentially, it's the same process. You're just working with not always better people, I've got to be honest. If I could have brought my crew from South Africa, I would have been happier.
Yeah.
Like, there are some people I would have loved to just transport across the land. And we must never think that we're not as good as.
Yeah.
We're just not as experienced as.
Yeah.
And so it was challenging working with some people who had way more experience than I did, and I just had to be better prepared than anyone.
And then, like, you know, I noticed that, I know that you love doing action movies, you know, I know, and you're good at that. You're getting on the set, you got $50 million to work with now. And really, there's like,
not enough.
Yeah, still not enough.
Not enough. Still not enough.
Can I get
never
a little
enough.
Bit more, right? Yeah?
I want some more. Yeah.
And how much of the stuff that you did was actually like on set and without having to rely on CGI?
There's a huge amount of CGI in this film. It's a submarine film, right? It's about Gerard Butler. He's the captain of a nuclear submarine.
And
I only had a real nuclear submarine for 2 days. It was my $7 billion set. It was a real nuclear submarine. I had it for 2 days.
How cool.
But for the rest of the time, I've got to create that submarine in special effects, or have a set, or have something that I can build later or add on to later and make it look like the real thing.
But then, I mean, it's impractical really to shoot in a submarine for the whole time, because it's really small, right?
Yeah, it's really tight. It's really cramped in there.
I mean, I'm going to ask you a technical question, and maybe I hope I don't lose you right now, but what kind of cameras did you shoot with?
I don't believe in shooting on anything too complex. For me, the camera's got to be an extension of my arm and an extension of my mind. So I like something very small, very versatile. I like something very real. I think we worked with the Alexas at 3.5K. I didn't even want something, you know, that had too much processing on the back end, which, I'm getting a bit technical here.
No, but I mean, that's
something that's very high quality. It's slower and harder to work with, and that's what I resent. I like things to be very organic. I like to get the camera out. You know me, I like a bit of handheld, like get in your face.
Yeah.
I like to make it happen. I actually brought my DOP. I had one crew member that I was allowed to bring with me. I brought my DOP, Tom Marais, from South Africa. He shot Number Number for me, and he came over. I gave him his break like they gave me mine.
Man,
that's
awesome.
Cool.
But here's the thing, right? Here's the thing. And I know we're still technical. I would have thought you would have gone for the big Panavision with the 35mm film in there, because you have that opportunity now. Light it for 2 days and then maybe shoot for like 1 minute.
You know, not at all. I mean, I like to get a momentum going on set. So I like to do it as simply as I possibly can. And video these days is good as film. I couldn't have, the budget couldn't actually, yes, your $50 million sounds like a lot, but these kinds of movies, I mean, Crimson Tide was made for $150 million. So in
that
fact,
that was like nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly, was exactly, exactly. So as far as this genre of big submarine war films go, it wasn't a lot of money. So I had to be very smart in how, and where I chose to spend that money. And I chose to spend it on what you saw in front of the camera, the sets, the, you know, the locations. Yeah. And that's where I wanted, that's what I wanted to come through.
Okay.
Yeah.
Candy?
Jeez, T, you were really going in there.
I'm about to go in some more, but I just want to give you a chance to just like come in here.
But you know, all I'm interested in is how the acting goes on set. And
you can ask some Hollywood questions like, what is it like to actually live in LA? Which part of LA do you live in?
I'm actually, you're going to get weirded out here, but I've decided to stay in South Africa. I live in South Africa and I base myself here because it doesn't matter where you live. And I love South Africa. And you know what? It makes me different to all the Hollywood directors. I'm not, hey guys, can you come over in 10 minutes? I'm like, no, I'm in Cape Town, dude.
Oh, wow.
You know, we're going to Skype, cool. You know, and they're like, whoa, that guy's, and I say, I've got an African sensibility, you know, and I'm going to bring that to your movie and I'm going to do something different. And this is how I've been pitching myself. And it's the only way I can be different to all the Hollywood directors. And it's incredibly competitive, as you know. So that's, I even feel like that's my edge. I live in Cape Town. I've been staying in, I've been between London and Hollywood for the last year and a half. I haven't been home because I've been doing this movie.
Yeah. But here's the thing, right? I mean, there's so many movies being done in Cape Town and so many TV series that you could literally live in Cape Town and do more work than if you were in LA.
But how unbelievable, right? That a lot of people want to live in Hollywood because that's the big dream. You think if you're living in Hollywood and Los Angeles, you've made it.
Yeah.
And you're saying, you know what, I want to live in Cape Town. I want to do work in Hollywood, but I still want to remain at home, which is incredible.
I think you can do that now. The world's a small place. Look, I don't want to be a Hollywood animal. I don't want to be out there hustling and like all I can think about is my Hollywood career. I actually love South Africa. I want to continue to make South African movies. My plan is to, my next movie I want to be is I want to do a South African film, and I want to, you know, bebop, and I actually want to bring those Hollywood films out here. I want them to shoot in South Africa, and I believe in our industry, and that's the way we're going to lift it up.
All right. Well, let's go back. I suppose starting at the last movie that you did in South Africa, Inamba Namba. It did amazingly well around the world, and there was talk of a remake. Is that still happening?
So Universal Studios bought the remake rights.
And
that was the first South African film in history to sell remake rights anyway.
Wow, congrats.
So it was huge. It was a huge event. But that doesn't guarantee they're going to make it. They've owned the rights. So what they've done in the interim is they're obviously going to Americanize it. They've written a screenplay, which I don't think is that great. And so they realize that they're going to keep working on it. So I hope that it happens.
Okay.
I hope that it pans.
Does it mean that you're included in it as a director, or they're now going to find someone else as well?
Yeah, they offered me to direct it, and I didn't want to repeat myself.
Oh, okay.
Oh, really?
Oh, okay. I suppose. Oh, all right.
You've done it well once. Don't take the risk of doing it badly the second time, you know?
But you pulled off a film with Inamba Namba that was boxing way above its weight, because what you had there, I know that we don't have the kind of budgets that you should to pull off something like that. I mean, talk us through some of the things that you had to do to be more creative to make a film like that.
Well, I mean, this is just a lesson to all South African filmmakers. Firstly, don't be too ambitious. Keep your ambitions very modest. I had only four locations in that film. You may not have realized it, but I only had four locations. I had an 80-page script, which is sort of 40 pages shorter than the normal script. And I chose my action moments very, very carefully.
Yeah.
So there were, actually, if you go back and look at that film, even though it feels fully action-packed, it's more about suspense and tension and mystery. And that, for me, is kind of the lost art of action films, which are all the spectacle, spectacle, spectacle.
Yeah, yeah.
And I chose my spectacular moments very carefully throughout the film and made those ones count. And I think that's what you got to do as South African filmmakers. We've got to be clever. We've got to cast it right. We've got to keep the scripts nice and tight. And we've just got to be smart about not creating something too ambitious that you can't possibly do justice to, and you'll just get shot out of the water by an American film that just does it better.
But how does one even start? When you say, okay, I'm going to be a director, where do you start? What do you start by doing?
That's a good question. You know, I saw a making of when I was about 16 years old. That takes us back to 1996. I think it was Never Ending Story was the movie.
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, yeah, good movie.
Yeah, where he like rises giant dog dragon thing.
I need to see this movie.
Never
it's a
ending
classic
story.
Is it a musical?
No, that was just the theme song. Oh,
that was Aha. I think Aha did that.
Aha did that. Yeah, that's right.
Right. And I just—it's a great blend of being technical and being creative, and it's about language, and it's about maths, and it's about spatial visual, and it's about interpersonal psychology. And this—you got to really be a jack of all trades as a director. So I think you kind of know when you're a director when you kind of want to do a bit of everything. But maybe, you know, I wasn't talented enough to act, and I wasn't, you know,
come on,
clever enough to do some
I
of the other jobs.
It.
So
the directing job is the coolest job on set, though.
It's the best job in the world, but the hardest. Yeah. I mean, it's challenging you on every dynamic of your personality.
You actually make the movie, and then the producers take the credit, basically, and then the actors get the awards.
Something
and
like that.
And if it doesn't work out, it's your fault.
Oh yeah. The buck stops
with you. Directing was terrible.
Yeah. The buck stops with you.
If it's any good, wow, he's a great actor. Yeah. Thank you.
I've never actually thought of that, but I do know that the director is an integral part of any show. I mean, I have no clue what producers do. That's why I asked you when you told me you produce. Directors, writing, editors. Obviously, the writer we know writes the script and whatever. But I think with directing, all of us think that you just sit in a chair and you pretty much dictate what needs to be done.
Something
so
like
you
that.
Do that. Oh, is it?
Yeah. Something like that, but like you have have a reason for it, right?
Yeah.
The director's job, just simply, is to... He's responsible for everything creative in the film.
Okay.
What it looks like, what everybody's wearing, who gets cast, how they say what they say, where they say it, what locations you shoot on. You know, all of that, what the sets look like, that's all the purview of the director, all right? But in a weird way, you don't have to have any specific skills because you hire people to build a set. You hire someone to shoot the film for you. You hire someone to put the makeup on. You're actually hiring people to do that. So it's really the true job of a director is to think.
Mm.
You've got to be able to think creatively
and
then communicate that creative vision to a bunch of real experts and let them then fulfill it. And you're kind of overseeing it and you manage it. I hate to say micromanage it, but you do.
Yeah.
Good directors are in there for every micro detail. And it's an orchestra. It's like you're a conductor. Mm. And you're conducting all these very talented musicians to try and create something. And it's very organic as well, which I love. You've got to be on your toes. It happens in the moment. You can have an amazing vision, which is obviously vital, but then you've got to be able to change as the movie changes.
Yeah. Sure, so you need to be adaptable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, incredibly.
Yeah.
And who are some of your favorite directors, like, of all time, that you just watch their movies and you go, this makes me happy?
Oh, there's so many fantastic directors. I was very influenced by the Coen brothers.
Okay. Fargo,
Raising Arizona,
No
Miller's
Country
Crossing,
for Old Men.
No Country for Old Men. I mean, they are incredible art directors, you know, but they're still, their movies have a commercial, you know, quality to them, and they're still fun to watch. So I love that blend of art and action. Darren Aronofsky as well. He did Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan. He's an incredible director, and he's always trying to do something innovative within the genre. And that's what I really try to do. And I think what Inumber Number was great at, it was a heist film, and you know that genre, yet we had this awesome South African spin to it, and the world just loved that. You know?
But do you ever watch films? Like, I watch films sometimes, and I'm like, how do they do that? Like, when I watch Gravity, right? And recently I watched Life, and you kind of forget that they can't just be floating around in space, because they didn't shoot this in space. They shot this like in a warehouse somewhere in downtown LA, right? How did they, do you ever like get up where you like, you just stumped? Like, I don't know how they did that.
All the time. Yeah. I mean, it's just the whole point of movies is you're not supposed to see how they did it, right? Otherwise it ruins the illusion and the story.
Yeah.
And I mean, you watch a movie like Gravity and you're just blown away by it. You know, and really, you shouldn't really be asking the question, how did they do that? You'd just be sort of immersed in the film.
Yeah.
I know we as filmmakers, we want to know, you know, how
did I want to see the trick. I'm like, that's a magic trick, but just show me the trick so I can go, oh, yeah, let's do it.
I know in Gravity, they used a special technique that's never been used before. Because obviously, the obvious way to make people float is just have them on strings and then lift them up. But then, you know, they float kind of funny, right?
Yeah.
Wherever the string is attached.
Mm. Exactly.
Which I think you saw in Life. You could kind of see that there was a string off that guy's back.
They
did something different. I'm not sure what they did in Gravity. Sometimes they even take a plane and then they go right up and they drop in the air, and then you get sort of 10 seconds of free fall, and they shoot that in a green screen environment, and then they can, now you really are weightless, and then they place you into the sets and you just have to quickly do whatever the action is for the scene.
Expensive idea, actually. It's like,
it's painful. Yeah.
But I must say, for me, like when I watch stuff like that, I always think to myself, this is magic that I see before me. That's what the whole point of like the big screen, the silver screen is. But I still want to know the trick, you know? And to go back to that, I know that with Gravity, they actually came up with a whole new camera rig as
That's
well.
That's right.
That had never been done.
Yeah.
Do you think that we'll ever get to that point in South Africa where, even on a technical basis, we can be inventors like they have, and they have ability to in Hollywood? Because, I mean, some of those things cost a lot of money. So you come and you say to the IDC, I've got a 5 million rand budget for a film, but get this, I need 20 million just to create a new kind of camera.
I don't know. I resist that idea. I do. I think we've got to be cleverer than that.
Look, okay.
Two things we've got to realize. One, we don't have the money.
Mm.
We don't.
And well, why?
We just don't have that. We don't have the money in this country. And secondly, we don't have the history of creating those kinds of magical effects.
Okay.
And so we've got to be different, and we've got to be more interesting. Look, you can do some pretty magical things with a camera. If you go onto Facebook or YouTube or whatever, you'll see some guys doing very cheap magical effects. That are kind of amazing, but like easy to do because they just position the camera in a certain way. You've all seen that one where they place a bunch of objects, but when you point the camera from a certain angle, all the objects seem to make another three-dimensional object that is completely different to what those objects are.
And that
kind of effect is a really amazing, incredible, and not expensive to do.
Yeah.
And that's what we've got to work on. I think we can't compete in Hollywood. We don't have the money. We don't have the history and expertise. And we've got to be smarter and cleverer and simpler and concentrate on what really makes movies work, which is great storytelling and innovative storytelling.
What do you think it's going to take for the South African industry to get to a point where we're competing with, you know, international movies?
Yeah, look, you have to compete because there's no model of movie making in this country that allows you to make your money back just with a local audience. Unless you make a movie for under a million rand, and that's close to impossible.
Yeah.
Or, you know, 3 million rand if you have a huge success. Because the business is just stacked against you. So we just have to be competitive. And the only way to be competitive is to be innovative. And I just don't see that happening in this country. We just, you know, firstly, obviously, it's very hard to do.
Yeah.
We're making great films, but these are films that are not traveling yet. And I don't know what that step up is. Maybe it's a mindset. Certainly a lot of luck is involved. You know, it's a numbers game. Great directors make terrible films, you know, and that's just a fact of the matter. And so we just got to keep...
Do you think it's a language thing as well? I mean, we are a diverse culture in South Africa. We're incredibly diverse. And... I don't know. It seems like even when we make a film in English, it just doesn't travel across because it just sounds not, you know, is it Australian? Is it kind of British? Why do they not sound American? Are those the factors that maybe the rest of the world kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I made a number in vernacular. It was a tough choice for me to make. I could have made it in English.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, I think the best decision I made was to keep it real and South African, and people appreciate that. You can't tell how people love the language. They're like, what is all those languages? I could tell it was different languages, I love the way they just, because, you know, Tamisha, when you're speaking in your home language, you can bring a bit of the slang in, and you can just make it your own, and audiences feel that, even if they don't understand the words. But it's a barrier because not everyone wants to watch a movie in
isiZulu
or something, with subtitles. It's a real challenge.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the answer is. I know there must be an answer. This is where you've got to be innovative, because just doing it in English, as you know, creates this kind of stilted vibe and it kind of ruins your film.
Well, let's go back to then before that. You did a couple of great English movies. Spud, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
I never thought anyone would, because I read the book before, obviously, the movie, and I loved the books. I loved all the books, but I never thought anyone would turn it into a movie, but I was always hoping that they would. What gave you that idea? Because it's like, I mean, the books were already about, 15 years old by that time?
I don't think that old. It wasn't my idea. It was the idea of the author, John von der Rote, whose good childhood friend was a movie producer. And so he went to him and said, look, I want to do this. And they said, okay, we need an international director and writer. So I saw an article in the newspaper that said they're going to make Spud the movie and they're looking for an international director. Apparently they were talking to some British guy, and I thought, no ways, this is wrong. We need a South African. So I got on the phone and I called these guys. I just called up the producer and I said, hey, listen, man, I'd made one movie at that point. I sent him my movie. I said, watch this movie. I want to be the guy. I want to do it for you. I want to direct this film for you. And he was very polite, and he basically said, no way. Forget
in
it.
In the most polite way possible.
Forget it, you're out.
Yeah.
So he said, but maybe you can help us with the screenplay, because I was a writer at that time. Because John von der Rote was going to write the screenplay. He's a novelist, and he was writing the next book, and he didn't have time, and so on. So they said, cool. I've lost me.
No, we're still there.
Oh, you got me. Okay, I just lost my headphones. So they said, cool, come along. We're going to give you a chance to write the screenplay. So I wrote the screenplay, and that went really well. And then I just kept pushing. I'm saying, you know, you should use a local director. Who do you want to use? And you know, eventually they said, okay, fine.
All right, Donovan, fine. Stop nagging. You got the part.
After that
I should try that next time. I'm like, I want to get cast in something.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you should really use South African.
But you know what I love about that? Yeah. We discuss it a lot on the show, and it's about basically just acting. You know, like you have to act. You can't just want something and sit back and hope it's going to happen. You know, you really got to go out there and push for it. And that's exactly what you did.
Yeah. You know? I just got on the phone.
Yeah. Which is amazing, because maybe the opportunity you wanted in the beginning didn't appear. It came in the form of, okay, you got to do the screenplay, which sounds like a lot of work. Mm. And then you were like, okay, I'll do the work first. And then after that, the opportunity actually presented
itself. Well, while the foot's in the door, right? Now you're going to see me. Door.
Yeah. And how was that like? You know, I mean, like you created something magical. You actually shot it at Michael House. What was it, during school holidays?
No, we shot during school time because I needed to use the kids as extras. So we had half the shoot in school holidays and half the shoot when the school was there.
Okay.
And it was very controversial because the board of the school didn't want us to shoot there because there's kids in the movie. There's kids drinking. There's a kid who sleeps with the teacher.
It's
set at Michael House. That's the real location. But they realized that they'd had since the books came out, they've never had a better admission. They were struggling to get admissions, and now they had more people than they could handle in their school. Yeah. Famous, and so they made a decision which they then reversed. Saying you could shoot at our school. So we shot Spud 1 there, and then they saw Spud 1 and they were like, no, they saw kids drinking. And exactly what we told them it was anyway. Yeah. But now they saw it for real on the screen. They were like, no ways, and you can't shoot you ever again. So we couldn't shoot Spud 2 there.
Where did you shoot Spud 2?
So we had to pretend we were there, so it was very difficult because they wouldn't even let us use the establishing shots we had of the school. So we kind of fudged it a bit. We shot at Saks in Cape Town and Rustenburg Girls.
Oh, wow.
Jeez.
So Michael House could be Rustenburg Girls. Michael House are a bunch of Rustenburg Girls.
Oh, no, it was a great pity because that school's so amazing. So I made the second film much more about the interiors. It was all happening interiors, inside the classrooms, inside the dorms.
Okay.
And so that was kind of what and I had to do. But I was sorry to do that.
We were
none the wiser. Yeah, no, we pulled it off because, there's... That's the magic.
But I mean, in spite of that, I'm sure it's done amazingly well for Michael House because now it's a school that you know about. Because at the end of the day, kids are going to do stuff. It's not about necessarily the school's reputation. It's kids going to do that.
Yeah, but you're not old boys. Get what school did you go to, Misha?
St. Albans.
Well, there you know, the old boys of St. Albans.
Yeah. We should shoot a movie there about Ush House. There was far more drinking.
I don't think that's a parent's decision call.
Because we should talk about that.
Oh, wow. I should send my kids to a school where they drink and have sex with teachers and stuff.
Well, we didn't. Nobody really had sex with the teachers because there were no hot teachers. But I'll tell you one thing that happened.
Disqualifying factor.
Because there was no internet porn back then. I was going to say. So you had to watch it old school on a video. You know,
on a cassette.
That's some kid bought from overseas.
Yeah, somebody brought from. They smuggled it in, man. And if you get caught, you're going to jail. So what? And they didn't allow us to keep the video machine for that very reason. That someone might put porn on.
Yeah.
So we always had to go to the housemaster and say that we were going to watch boxing, and we're going to record it because boxing matches are always late at night.
Oh,
you know,
Klitschko and Joshua
fought recently. But I think back in the day, boxing matches. I don't know if they used to happen during the week. Because it wasn't always Saturday night or Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And then we'd put out this machine and you had to pay a 2 rand cover charge.
2 rand cover charge. and who was the 2 rand going to?
The guy who owns the video cassette.
No, just free at our school. Come on.
Really? Yeah. You guys don't understand the market.
He wasn't very entrepreneurial. So then you pay 2 rand and then for
everybody
how long?
Paid. Until the video's done. The whole video. Like an hour and a half. How long are these things? Why are you asking me these questions?
I'm just thinking, the quality must have been really crap,
though. The quality was awful.
And all pixelated and stuff.
There were only small TVs back then, right? So if you're at the back of the TV room, you're quite far from the screen.
And how loud was the volume? Because obviously you can't
get
it.
Because if the housemaster walked in...
Okay, so who's in charge of the TV?
But it's just always a copy of a copy of a copy,
right?
Yeah, it's just a bit grainy. You're not always sure what you're looking at.
It was tough back in the day. Guys, you don't understand the power, how much power you have when you have internet. And you can do this on your phone now. So it's not even awkward where you have a room full of other guys and you're at that age, you know.
Yeah. That was going to be my next question. Yeah. You're in a room full of other guys.
You got to save those images. Put them in the hard drive to use later.
How did we get I don't from know. An international director telling us how incredible a set is to directing porn, watching porn.
That was a successive spread. I think everybody, you know, certainly our age anyway, remembers being at a boarding school like that and what you had to go through.
But also the casting there was very interesting. You had John Cleese.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your lead. Troy. Is he South African?
He is South African by birth, and then he went to live in Australia. He has two South African parents.
Okay.
But he actually speaks naturally in an Australian accent.
Funny thing is, because he pulled off that South African accent.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A very good one.
He just sounded like he was...
He's got perfect pitch. He can sing really beautifully. Mm. He sings on the phone.
Yeah, I know that. He's a YouTube sensation.
Oh, yeah. Now I think Time voted him one of the 10 most influential teenagers
in
the world. Imagine.
Wow. Time magazine.
He's become huge. Yeah, no, he was amazing. You could just give him the line once in terms of the accent and he'd get it straight away.
Wow.
And nailed it. But look, his parents were with him all the time and they speak South African... In South African accents all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very easy for him to key into that because that's how he
was. Okay, so he flew out here, did it, and then went straight back
home. That's right.
And John Cleese was on the phone.
Yeah, John Cleese. How was he like to work with? Is he totally funny all the time? Is it like you're on Monty Python?
No, he's quite serious, actually. You know?
Oh, really?
He didn't realize how smart he is. He's this qualified lawyer, barrister. And comedy is a serious business, guys.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got to understand what it is to be funny, and he knows what his sweet spot is to be humorous. He can just turn it on in front of the camera. He knows exactly what to do, and you know, when you work with him, you can see why he's a legend. You know, he has that charisma and the intelligence, and I think when you add those two things together, you get something pretty special.
And who's your ideal actor to work with?
Everyone asks me that. I don't know. You know, I think there's so many incredibly talented actors. I'm as happy with working. I just want someone who's totally committed to the moment and wants to collaborate with me.
You know,
not every actor is like that. They kind of want to do their own thing, which is fine, and you can get a good performance. But I don't enjoy that. And I'd as soon work with an amazingly talented South African actor who just wants to collaborate and wants to get into it, and is going to throw themselves 100% into the moment. And that's hard to do. It takes a commitment. It's emotionally tough to do.
Yeah.
And so anybody who's prepared to do that, I want to go the extra mile with. And the names to me are just the names because they've been lucky and you know they're in the right place at the right time.
And the other thing that we see with Hollywood is like these communities. There's the Australian community. There's now the British community, I suppose. Is there a growing South African community now that you noticed since
you know life? Filmmakers sure. I mean there's a number of South Africans overseas doing tremendously well, you know, Gavin Hood, Jonathan Liebesman, who are, you know, established Hollywood directors, and they all started out here in South Africa. Even Neil Blomkamp who did District 9, and so you know these are all South Africa. They are tremendously successful when they go overseas.
But they become a community, because that's the thing, that's what I'm asking, because
support each other.
When you think about it, Australians have like taken over Hollywood because they became that community. It's like, okay, I'm going to bring you all one by one, and the British have been doing that, right?
Yeah.
Are we doing that?
I don't think so. I don't think we have that sense of community strong enough in South Africa right now. Look, I did bring my DOP as part of that idea of let's bring the South Africans.
I mean, did Gavin like put in a word for you and say, oh, no, Donovan, he's a good okay, put him in.
Maybe. I don't know.
Behind the scenes.
I hope so.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I think that's what we need. I feel like we kind of go as one person, you succeed by yourself, and then that's it, you know? And then one person goes, they succeed by themselves, and that's kind of it.
It's a Charlize thing.
Sort of. Okay. I mean, like, when you look at the Australians and the British,
you'll
see a movie, and literally all the HODs are Australian, and it's like Wolverine or something, you know?
I wonder if that's what they're doing. I don't know if they are reaching out and bringing across their own friends or own community.
I mean, certainly like The Great Gatsby. Who directed that again?
Baz Luhrmann.
You know, and you look at his crew list and you're like,
How did you go Google them? Sorry, Don. I'm just so curious. How do you know? Like
I did actually. Okay. I'm a bit of a movie nerd like
that. Yeah, like what were you saying, Don? Sorry.
Well, I think Baz, for example, I mean, Baz is a huge director. He obviously has the people he likes to work with, and because he's famous enough and strong enough, he can say, this is my team. I'm not at that stage then. I mean, I went overseas and they told me, this is your team.
Yeah.
And even to bring my DOP from South Africa over was a hell of a process. You know, they were very resistant initially, and he had to pitch. And At the end of the day, he was actually just better than the other guys. So yeah. That's how he got in. And in a talent-based industry, people do move alone, you know, because you get spotted for your talent and then you're plucked and pulled. And you'll actually weigh yourself down if you try and pull everyone
pull
with
everyone,
you.
Yeah.
Just you become a heavyweight.
I suppose the other thing is, it's actually, people don't realize how difficult it is to get into Hollywood. Everyone thinks I'm really talented here. Everyone loves me. I'm just going over there and I'll do a couple of auditions. But like you said, you have to first have a couple of people around you that are pushing for you before someone even gives you a chance to pitch.
When I said that I hustled for 3 years, I had three agents working for me.
They
work in teams of three. I had one of the major agencies in the United States working for me. They're sending me scripts every week. Even then, it took me 2 to 3 years to get in. I have an attorney as well in Hollywood who does a lot of that kind of stuff for you, a lot of the negotiating for you.
Yeah.
So I've got a team of guys. I could never, on my own, I would never have made it. But with this team, it still took me 2.5 years to get a good project.
And I'm sure it wasn't like some Mickey Mouse little agency. It was like some top-notch
stuff. That's ICM. One of the three biggest agents in Hollywood.
Well, I mean, you know, not to name names. I did go to the ICM party at the 2005 Golden Globe Awards.
Nice.
Name drop.
I was in the room.
Who else was in the room? Name drop.
Matthew McConaughey, he was there. You know, at the time he was dating Penelope Cruz. It was cool. He was speaking to Philip Noyce and I was speaking to Penelope. And it was cool. You know, she...
And she didn't give you a wink wink.
No, I mean, I try to keep it like above board because I respect Matthew. You know, I like Matthew. Liam Neeson was there.
If you guys weren't friends, it would have been a different situation.
Been a different story, you know. But Matthew was cool.
Okay.
Do you go to those kind of parties? Because everyone, like, you know, in the beginning, it's like, you just go to these parties and hopefully someone will spot you.
My agent just sets me up when I'm in Hollywood. Meetings, parties.
Yeah.
It must be exhausting because you're going to parties every other night and then you're going to meetings every other day.
It's tiring. You've got to be on, you know. You've got to be the best possible version of yourself.
All the time.
Because even at those parties, you're networking. They're putting you in front of people.
Yeah.
And you literally have 5 seconds as this guy's sort of passing you and you've just got to, you know, make an impression. I don't like doing that, but I realize it's part of the gig.
Did you ever feel like, I got the sense when I was there a couple of times that it sometimes feels like there's a lot of people who are very desperate to make it in there. It's hard. There's a lot of clutter. There's all these people there who, you know, is a cab driver and, you know, he wants to make it. He's a lawyer from another country. He wants to make it. He's a doctor, but his actual dream is to be a Hollywood.
Yeah.
Did you ever get that sense? I mean, is that still happening right now? I haven't been to Hollywood for a while. Did you get there and feel like
everybody is an actor?
Everybody's a director. Everybody's got
the Uber driver.
Yeah.
Jeez.
The guys punching your ticket. All those guys want to be in. You know, so it's very hard. It's tough.
It's a little bit heartbreaking, don't you think? Sometimes?
Oh yeah. It's very heartbreaking, and you get hustled a lot. There's a lot of hustling going on. People want to get in. People want to meet you. You know, the minute they identify you as someone who's got to step in the door, they want to sort of get on your coattails and get dragged in with you. So you get a lot of that going on, but you understand it. You need a lot of luck, to be sure. You need a lot of luck, and luck is not something you can necessarily control.
Yeah,
sure, you can hustle. You can, and maybe you'll get lucky. Like I got lucky, but it's a tough business. Hats off to anyone who gets out there and tries it. I mean, you know it, to be sure. Come on.
No, but it was really great talking to you. How much longer are you going to stay?
I'm here for a couple of weeks and then I go back to finish the film. We're just in a hiatus at the moment and then we're going to get it done.
What part of the film are you still having to shoot now?
It's all shot. It's all edited. We've got to do the visual effects. I've got 200 visual effects shots in the film.
Sure.
Each shot they can work on for anywhere between 3 and 6 months. There'll be a number of companies. There are too many shots for one company. Each company will have about 200 people working on those shots.
Man, this sounds like the credit.
This is why the credit roll is so long.
You know what I mean? Yeah. The credit roll for Kong was like 10 minutes.
Yeah. That's because VFX is tremendously difficult and labor intensive. Everyone's got to texture it. You know, a lot of water stuff because it's a submarine film. You know, you got to make that water look like water, and that's very hard to do. It takes a lot of time.
I hear there's a place there called the it's basically a CGI farm. Did you go to it? Did you see it? Have you seen it?
Well, these farms they're kind of, you know, they're just huge amounts of computers linked to each other so they can just do the hard crunching, the rendering and the texturing and those things that just take ungodly amounts of hours to finish, you know. And these are typical. You'll see them all over.
So, okay, what's the coolest thing you can do with CGI? Can you actually put a six pack on me for the entire movie? Is that even possible?
It is totally possible. And sure, without naming names, I know of a star who recently had to go do a reshoot because he didn't like his six-pack.
Oh!
And then,
no!
And they lined the reshoot up for him. He had some time to get into shape, and he didn't get into shape. And so they had to just painstakingly CGI. Put that six-pack in frame
oh,
by frame.
It makes me so happy, actually. It
and gives now me feel normal.
And now he looks like the man.
Well, that makes me feel a little bit happy. I don't want to lie. That it's not as perfect in Hollywood. Yeah. It makes me happy. You?
I feel at ease.
Okay.
I'm like,
You CT, you don't even
that
need
was
your
the question. That was the only question I really wanted to ask him.
This whole interview.
Yeah, I just wanted to sound a little bit intelligent and then ask other stuff. But that question is made
that
me very
made your
happy.
Day.
Yeah.
And what's next for you, Dom? Before you leave us, what's next?
I've got a couple of South African films lined up. An amazing film about the Sharpeville Six.
Oh.
Which I'm really excited about. I have a movie called Zoo City, which is based on Lauren Bucher. She's an amazing South African author. It's a sci-fi novel set in Johannesburg.
Dope.
In Hillbrow. Amazing, nice. Amazing book, and that's won a lot of awards all over the world. So there's that film. And there's a film, I've got a couple of other South African films, one called Gorgon, which is set in the Karoo. It's a really weird film about a Gorgon fossil, which is a fossil that is worth $10 million. Only one's ever been found. It's about
what's a Gorgon?
Gorgon were the beasts that ruled before the dinosaurs. So Gorgons were actually the dinosaurs before the dinosaurs were the dinosaurs, right?
How cool.
And then Gorgons went extinct like 256 million years
what?
Ago. And they went extinct so that the dinosaurs could rule the earth. Dinosaurs went extinct so that we could rule the earth. So they were the rulers of the earth 256 million years ago.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, it's about them. It's about a little kid from the township who goes looking for this fossil because he knows it's worth $10 million.
Wow. Well,
it's going to be an incredible story.
I can't wait to see it, man. On that note, we're out.
Yay!
See you next week.
Bye, guys.
Ciao. Cliffcentral.com.